Hello, and welcome back to ACRAC. I'm Jed Wolpaw, and we've got a really fun episode for you today. I have with me, for only the second time ever, one of my residents. Stephen Freiberg, as some of you may remember, did an episode or two when he was a resident, has continued to do some since he graduated, but I now have another one of my residents, a fantastic doctor named Marius Fassbinder. We are lucky to have him as a resident. He's got a wealth of experience, first in Germany before coming over here, and then, of course, here as a resident. And Marius has taken a particular interest in the topic of hydroethyl starches, and so we are going to talk about that today. This episode is going to be featured at anesthesiologynews.com, as many of the episodes are. You can go over there and check it out. And while you're there, you can check out a lot of the other great news and content that they have. It's a great site, as people will know from checking it out in the past. And I encourage you to go over there, check out the ACRAC stuff that they have, and see what else they have to offer. Marius, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me on the show. It's awesome to be here.
So Marius, let me ask you, this is a really interesting topic. How did you become interested in it?
All right. So I got interested in this topic because when I trained in Germany, we used hydroxyethyl starches quite extensively. And when I came here and started my training in the U.S., I noticed that almost no one uses it here. And talking to colleagues whenever I mention that we used to use them in Europe, and to some extent we still do, people looked at me and were like, are you crazy? The evidence is so clear, you shouldn't use them. And that motivated me to come here and talk a little bit about it, because there's a little more to know about colloids in general and hydroxyethyl starch. The evidence is not that clear. And while it's not my intention to promote the clinical use of hydroxyethyl starches, I think it's very, very good to know the differences and the little things you need to look out for when you interpret those studies.
Absolutely. That sounds great. So let's start very basically. Let me ask you, when you think of colloids, what is that? What is a colloid?
So when we use a colloid in clinical practice and in anesthesia, we think about a molecule of homogeneous non-crystalline substance that ideally binds water within the intravascular system. So it's a molecule with water binding properties. And we differentiate between different kinds of colloids that we use in clinical practice. And on the one side, we have the natural colloids. And on the other side, we have synthetic colloids. Part of the natural occurring colloids we use are albumin. We have it in a 5% concentration here, also at a higher concentration, up to 25%, and FFPs. And when we talk about the synthetic colloids, we think about hydroxyethyl starches, which I will refer to as starch, and gelatins and dextrins.
Great. All right. So that's what falls under the category of colloids. And then why do we care? What do we use them for?
So why do we use colloids? Just like I mentioned a minute ago, we think colloids are more effective as a volume expander, meaning we use it to stabilize cardiac preload in certain clinical settings. Well, whether that is true or not is probably context sensitive. So the amount of colloid that actually stays within the intravascular system depends on the clinical situation we use it in. It depends on the patient, and even within the patient, and it depends on which organ this colloid is going to. And when I think about fluid or colloid, crystalloid or colloid therapy, I make a certain differentiation within my head. When I look at a patient that comes into the OR, I differentiate between fluid therapy and volume therapy. So what do I mean by that? When I talk about fluid therapy, I think about losses that occur naturally, such as sweating, evaporation, insensible losses, urine, all the things that you and I lose on a daily basis, and we need to replace it with a fluid. And when I talk about volume therapy, I refer to intravascular volume losses that we see in surgery. So let's say you have a leg amputation and you're losing volume from your intravascular system. And it is very helpful in clinical practice to make that differentiation, because you would never want to replace a fluid loss with a colloid. You would want to treat that with maintenance crystalloid therapy. And the role of colloids in anesthesia mostly comes into play when we talk about volume losses, so losses from your intravascular system.
Now, Maris, when you say you would never want to treat a fluid loss with colloid, why is that?
So why is that? Because the whole idea behind the colloid is to treat intravascular volume in anesthesia. There are exceptions in medicine where you use albumin for different kinds of therapies, but for this talk, we're going to focus on anesthesia practice mostly. And it doesn't make sense from a theoretical standpoint of view to replace a fluid loss with a colloid, because you're really just losing fluids, salt-based solutions from your body that do not need a colloid replacement. And this is very important because you can encounter clinical situations where one might think, oh, a colloid is a good solution, but it's really not. And one of the good examples are if you're hypovolemic from dehydration. So you're walking through the desert and people find you after 2 days and you're now hypotensive. You do not want to treat that with a colloid, because what you really need is a salt-based solution and replace the things that you've lost over those 2 days.
And I love that. I think that's exactly right, is that when we're thinking about this, we want to think about replacing what's been lost. So if all you've lost is essentially a crystalloid solution, then replacing that with crystalloid makes sense. If you've lost what is essentially a colloid or blood product type solution, then replacing it with a colloid makes more sense. So I like that distinction quite a lot. All right. So we are going to distinguish between those two, and then, you know, what is the advantage if we're losing volume to using a colloid to treat it?
So the theoretical advantage, and whether it is a true clinical advantage or not, will need to be discussed throughout this talk. But the theoretical advantage is that you stabilize your cardiac preload, meaning you increase the amount of fluid that is coming back to your heart so you can pump it out again. And why is that? Because we think for a colloid, there exists a structure that holds this colloid within the intravascular volume to a bigger extent than a crystalloid. Now, we thought the ratio was 5:1. Let's say you have an isooncotic colloid, such as 130 hydroxyethyl starch or 5% albumin, and you look at a crystalloid, an isotonic crystalloid, not all of that crystalloid stays within your intravascular system. Now, we thought the portion of the colloid that stays intravascular is much bigger than we now know it actually is. We're more talking about a 1:2, 1:3 ratio. But as I mentioned before, that very much depends on the clinical situation you find yourself in.
Okay, so we know that only a portion of the crystalloid is going to stay, and then only a portion of the colloid as well, or how much of a colloid is going to stay?
So in the ideal patient, and there's no such thing as the ideal patient, that comes into the OR and loses about 0.5 liter of blood from his intravascular system, and we give this patient a 5% albumin solution, we think that almost 100% of that solution stays within the intravascular system. Now, we know from experimental studies that it really depends on the pre-existing volume status the patient is in. If the patient is normovolemic to start with and we give them a liter of albumin, not all of that stays within the intravascular system because there's a structure in place, and more and more evidence shows that the structure called glycocalyx is being damaged when you overload a patient. But let's try to use a clinical example to give you an idea. One very common practice we do is we place an epidural in a laboring patient. And once we place the epidural, we give a medication, and that medication makes the patient hypotensive because the local anesthetics we inject cause peripheral vasodilation below the level of the block. Now, why is the patient hypotensive? The patient is hypotensive because their blood vessels dilate and blood is lost in the periphery. If we give this patient a crystalloid solution, not all of it stays within the intravascular system. And what we really need is more blood coming back to the heart so we can stabilize preload and maintain normal tension. If you give the same patient a colloid solution after you inject it, more of that solution stays within the intravascular system, and you're able to maintain blood pressure to a bigger extent. But none of those two actually treat the problem. The real problem we have here is peripheral vasodilation, as we also see going into anesthesia. As we start a case, when you give your anesthetic and people become hypotensive, that's a relative volume depletion, but the volume is still there, and it's very, very controversial whether you should treat that with crystalloids or colloids, because that's not the solution to the problem. The solution to the problem is using a vasopressor.
I couldn't agree more. Absolutely. So we want to be aware of when it's appropriate to use any kind of volume. And you mentioned vasodilation caused by anesthesia really, I think, should be treated with a vasopressor, as you've said. But let's talk about the glycocalyx you mentioned. Obviously, we could really dive quite deep into the glycocalyx, but do you want to say a few more words about what it is and why we care about it?
So that's a great question, because I think the glycocalyx is a very important structure we need to look out for in anesthesia. Very simply put, the glycocalyx is a layer that covers the luminal surface of endothelial cells. And its role seems to be to prevent proteins from the intravascular space to freely go into the interstitium, into the extracellular space that surrounds the blood vessels. And many, many things affect that structure. We know that hypervolemia, as mentioned, causes damage to the glycocalyx, so it cannot hold back larger molecules that you give, and the result is edema. And sepsis can do it, systemic inflammation can do it, as we see in SIRS. Many, many clinical scenarios can cause injury. Another prominent one is ischemic and reperfusion injury. We know that it also causes damage to this structure, and it becomes problematic in clinical practice. When you look at a septic patient and you think of this classical patient in septic shock, post-fluid resuscitation, they have edema throughout their body. And one of the reasons they have so much edema is because fluid is leaking out of their intravascular system.
Right. And so we've lost this glycocalyx or damaged it. And so part of what's happening is that the vessels can no longer hold the volume in. Now, if you have damage to the glycocalyx, as you mentioned earlier, colloids may not stay in as much as they would normally stay in intravascularly either, right?
Exactly. So the whole idea of your colloid solution becomes problematic because you no longer have a structure in place that helps prevent those albumin or starch molecules from leaving the intravascular space. While the glycocalyx is intact, molecules bigger than maybe 70 kilodalton have a hard time leaving the intravascular space in most organs. But when this structure is no longer present, we have a hard time. And again, keep in mind that hypervolemia can also cause damage to this structure. So if you start with a normal volemic patient, giving them a large colloid or crystalloid bolus may cause damage.
Right, absolutely. So Marius, before we move on to talking about starches specifically, is there anything you want to say about kind of colloids in general before we move on?
Yes, I would add one more thing to make it very clear to the listeners that the volume effect of colloids is actually something that is really hard to measure, because some of the studies were done in healthy volunteers or in animal models where you start at a normal intravascular volume level. And the way they used to measure the volume effect of these medications was assessed by dilution of hematocrit or hemoglobin. Now, it's a little more complicated than that, because we now know that this is very much inaccurate. So there's a couple of studies out there that use certain tracer methods to look at the volume effect, and they seem to be a little more accurate. So the idea is you inject the tracer, and then you give the medication, you give the colloid, and then you inject another tracer and look at how much tracer is left within your intravascular volume. But it's everything but clear how much actually stays intravascular. And this is even more confounded by the clinical situation you find yourself in, whether you're in the ICU treating a septic patient or you in the OR, you're treating a trauma patient. It really depends on where you start off and where you end up. And it's not an answer that you can say for sure, oh, 100% of the solution stays intravascular or 30%. It's really hard to estimate that.
Great. Well, that's important to know. And as you said, the example of, for example, a patient who has hemorrhaged out half their blood volume versus a patient who had an epidural placed and is now vasodilated, those are two patients who both may be hypotensive but may respond very differently to volume and may have a different percentage of any given volume, whether crystalloid or colloid, stay intravascular.
Exactly.
All right. Let's talk about starches, your kind of area of interest, what got you interested in doing this podcast. Let's start with the basic question. What is a hydroethyl starch?
So a hydroethyl starch is a either potato-based or maize-based polymer of amylopectin, a starch, meaning you have hundreds of glucose rings in your starch molecule, and they make it up, and they come in different sizes and different molar substitutions, different weight. So I think it's useful to talk about that for a second.
Great, let's do it.
Just so the listeners understand that starch doesn't mean starch. There's different kinds of starches. And the packages are usually labeled with three numbers. The first number is the percentage of the concentration. So let's give you a classic example. You have a 6%, 130/0.4 starch solution. So what does that mean? That means that you have 6% of starch in that solution. So if you have 1 liter, that contains about 60 gram of starch molecules.
Okay.
And then we move on to the second number, in this case 130, and that refers to the mean molecular weight. Now, you don't need to know the very detail of that, but the pharmacodynamic is influenced by the mean molecular weight. If it's a heavy starch, the older starches were heavier starches. They were like 450 or 200, and they remain within the body for a longer period of time than your 130 starch. And the third number, the 0.4, refers to the molar substitution of the glucose rings. So what do I mean by that? I mean your starch molecule consists of a number of glucose rings, and some of them are substituted with hydroxyethyl groups on position 2 and 6 of your glucose ring. And that influences also the pharmacodynamic of that very solution, and it also classifies the different types of starch. So the older starches had a molar substitution ratio of 0.7 and 0.5. They're commonly referred to as heta starch or penta starch. And the newer starch solutions have a molar substitution ratio of 0.4, and they're referred to as tetrastarches. And studying for the boards, I came across questions addressing that. For example, with the older starches, the penta starch or the heta starch, you have a higher risk of causing coagulopathy than the newer ones. And they also, again, remain in your system much longer than the newer ones, which may explain some of the side effects that we see with those older ones.
Yeah, so I think that's really key. And you mentioned with that second number, the mean molecular weight, that if very small molecules, you know, less than 40 to 70 kilodaltons, right, are going to be very rapidly excreted by the kidneys. Presumably much larger molecules are going to be a little harder to excrete by the kidneys. They're going to hang around longer.
Exactly. And this is very important. And the second number, the 130, using our example, refers to the mean molecular weight. So it means that that solution contains a number of different size starch molecules. Mm-hmm. The smaller ones are being excreted quite quickly with the kidneys, whereas the larger ones stay within your intravascular volume a little longer. The cutoff value here is somewhere in between 60 and 70 kilodalton, so 130 is 130 kilodalton.
Mm-hmm.
And you also have to know that if you start off with a molecule that is, let's say, 300 kilodalton, and it's being cut into three molecules of 100 kilodalton, that influences your colloid osmotic pressure that is being exerted by the starch itself. So the in vitro colloid osmotic pressure is different than the one you see in the body in vivo.
Absolutely. And you mentioned that there's different starches, and that also, you know, may influence, and we may get to this a little later, but some of the effects that have been seen or some of the concerns that have been expressed have to do with the effect on the kidneys, and that may be influenced by both the size and the molar substitution of the specific starch that we're talking about.
It may be. That's the belief. Yes.
Great. So you mentioned 6% earlier. Is that kind of a more or less isotonic starch?
So isotonic refers more to the crystalloid content of the colloids. And this is maybe another important thing to know when you hang a colloid solution and you use that starch, it is dispersed in a crystalloid solution. So every single starch solution that you use, and this is also true for albumin solutions, is dispersed in a crystalloid solution. So that is what is affecting your isotonicity.
Mm-hmm.
And what is affecting your colloid osmotic pressure is more the percentage and the number of decent-sized molecules that you give. And we're usually looking at a colloid osmotic pressure of 25 to 30 with the common starch solutions and with the 5% albumin solution.
Great. So you mentioned before that if we have a 6% solution and it's a liter of hydroethyl starch, that's going to have about 60 grams of the polymer. So what does that compare to when you're thinking about other, whether albumin or crystalloid, what would you think of it as kind of similar to?
So the similar solution would be 5% albumin. Those have about the same colloid osmotic pressure. Mm-hmm. They're called iso-oncotic. Meaning they have the same or a similar colloid osmotic pressure than we find in healthy plasma. And you can oppose that to hyperoncotic colloid solutions such as 10% starch solutions or 25% albumin solution. And I would be very, very careful with using hyperoncotic colloid solutions because all you're trying to achieve is your baseline level, your baseline physiology. And if you find yourself during surgery and now you introduce a surgical stimulus that causes dysregulation, and now you add a hyperoncotic solution to that that may even draw water from your extracellular space into the intravascular system, you're causing even more disturbance, and it's probably not a smart idea. There is a role for 25% albumin solution, mm-hmm. mostly in medicine and maybe a selective liver surgery procedures. But in common anesthesia practice, there's probably a very small role for hyperoncotic solutions.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Great. So when you are thinking about maximum doses, is that important? Are there maximum doses for starches?
Yes, there are. And this raises a very, very important point because I like to look at crystalloids and colloid solutions in general as medications. And medications come with an indication, a contraindication, a certain dose, a dose range, and scenarios where you can use them or not. And for the newer starch solutions, the maximum dose was 50 ml per kg and day. It's not so clear for albumin because it may depend on your clinical scenario.
Mm-hmm.
As long as you don't cause hypervolemia or a hyperchloremic metabolic acidosis from the saline that the albumin is suspended in, there's less limitations to the maximum dose. But starches, and this is very important, come with a maximum dose. And once you exceed that dose, you see a sharp increase in side effects.
Great, and that's a perfect segue to my next question, which is, what are the side effects of hydroethyl starches? What are we concerned about there?
So a lot of the trials that looked at the use of hydroxyethyl starches, both in animals and humans, found signs of kidney injury with the use of starch. Whether this is true, whether this is a true mechanism from the starch or it's a hyperviscosity phenomenon is somewhat unclear, but it is clear that in ICU patients, you see that once you exceed a certain dose and it becomes worse. Another side effect is coagulopathy, especially the older starches, the pentastarch and the hexastarch and the heta starches. They can bind von Willebrand factor or factor 8 and other factors that are important in coagulation, and they can cause coagulopathy. Now, we thought that for tetrastarches, this is not so much of a problem, but in septic patient, it really is, and we should try to stay away from those in this patient population. And another thing that is being caused by starches is pruritus, and this is independent of what kind of starch you use, and it's also a dose-dependent effect. The more starch you use, the more you see that your patients become itchy. And then another thing is it can cause an anaphylactoid reaction, and the incidence is about 0.05%, which is significantly less than dextrans, for example.
And so there can be some accumulation, right, especially of the larger molecular weight starches?
Yes, they are found to accumulate in the tissue. One way of the metabolism of starches involves that some of the molecules are being taken up by the so-called reticular endothelial system, and they're being stored in cells and everything, and they can linger around for a long, long time. So a starch is never a good idea for a long-term treatment.
Great. And then what about the renal dysfunction? Does it matter about the low molecular weight starches versus higher molecular weight starches?
So it matters. It appears that we see less kidney injury in the lower molecular weight starches with the lower molar substitution. And one important thing to know is I would never use a starch in a patient that has any sort of pre-existing kidney injury. Even with the newer ones, even if you can, if you say that, oh, the evidence is not as clear, I would not, in no circumstance, use this on a patient that has kidney injury.
So that's a contraindication. Are there other contraindications, you think, for using hydroethyl starches?
I think there is. I think coagulopathy is a contraindication. So if you're far advanced in your surgery and your patient becomes coagulopathic, that's a contraindication. Hyperhydration is a contraindication. Previous allergic reactions to starches is probably a contraindication. I mentioned before dehydration would be a contraindication, and sepsis, in my opinion, is a contraindication to starch use. Now, people will argue with that, but I would not use a starch solution in a septic patient.
And why is that?
Because in a septic patient, we mentioned earlier, they very much have lost the structure that we think plays an important role to hold your colloid within the intravascular system, meaning the glycocalyx. And we know from multiple studies that in septic and severe inflammatory syndromes, such as a burn patient, you have capillary leakage. And there's really no rationale for using a colloid in a patient that leaks it from its intravascular system. So I would not use it in a septic patient.
Great. So people are going to be wondering, you know, why would I ever use these, right? I mean, even without these contraindications, there's these potential side effects. There's some potential for accumulation, coagulopathy, for, you know, a very rare rate of an anaphylactoid reaction, for some renal dysfunction. So I'm sure listeners are going to say, you know, why would I want to use them? Is the answer because in some places it may be cheaper than albumin, or are there, is there another reason?
So this is a very great question. I think it really gets to the bottom of this. If I can use 5% albumin versus a starch solution, I would always opt for the 5% albumin, just based on some of the theoretical implications and thoughts. But albumin comes from pooled plasma. It needs a donor. It comes from humans. So it's limited. The amount of albumin is limited that we can use. And the other thing is it's more expensive than a starch, which plays a role for a lot of other places. In Europe, a starch solution is significantly cheaper than albumin. And then you have clinical settings where you don't have access to blood products or vasopressor therapy, such as remote places or low and middle income countries that do not have as efficient blood donation systems in place. And they really can only use a synthetic colloid. So it may play an important role in those settings. At this point, I want to mention a very important thing. So we discussed extensively how you would use a colloid in a patient that loses their intravascular volume. Now, if you think about a patient that comes in with a massive trauma, let's say multiple gunshots to the abdomen and the chest, and they're hypovolemic because they're bleeding out, I would not use a colloid or a crystalloid. If your patient is bleeding out, you need to use blood products. Mm-hmm. Okay? You really don't want to waste time loading the patient with crystalloid or colloid solution. What you really need to do in that scenario is you need to give blood. And only if you have no availability to blood products, you can think in this scenario about using a colloid solution. It may save you. We don't know.
Great. All right. So that's a good reason to think about it if you're in those scenarios. Are there studies that people... you'd recommend people take a look at if they want to get more information on this? What do you recommend?
So there's a bunch of studies out there that looked at the use of starch solutions, primarily in the ICU setting. And you have to know before we talk about these studies that there was a scientific scandal in Germany in 2008 where one of the researchers who studied starches extensively and found a lot of positive effects on starches was found to be fraudulent. So they had to retract a lot of study this author was involved with. Mm-hmm. So I'm not going to address any of the studies that this author was involved with. I'm going to talk mainly about the big ICU trials, and there's a bunch of them out there. The earliest one from 2008 is the Vicep trial that looked at the use of pentastarches in septic patients. Then there's the 6S trial. It's a Scandinavian trial from 2012 that looked at the use of starches in septic patients. And there's the CHESS trial, also around 2012, 2013, that looked at over 7,000 patients and found that it causes kidney injury and increases the need for RRT. So I'm going to summarize those three trials that we looked at because all of them show evidence for kidney injury in mm-hmm. septic patients, increased need for renal replacement therapy, and even increased mortality after 90 days in some scenarios. And when you look at those studies, you really want to look at them a little more closely, and you start to realize that they have some flaws in it. One of them being they were done and conducted in septic patients.
Mm-hmm.
Septic patients, to start with, as we mentioned, most likely don't have a structure to hold that colloid intravascularly. So you lose your volume effect that was your intention to use it. And the other thing is that those studies mostly had a delay in recruitment of their patients, meaning that the randomization occurred after a good while, 12 to 24 hours after patients had been admitted to the ICU with sepsis. And if you listen to last week's podcast with Pam Lipset, you realize that one of the most important things in the therapy of sepsis is the initial resuscitation, so given fluids early. So there's a suspicion that probably a good amount of those patients included in those studies were already resuscitated by the time they were randomized. And as I mentioned before, there's really no role of colloids, especially starches, in the maintenance therapy of your ICU patient. It's really just for an initial resuscitation. The other thing that these studies were criticized for is some of the studies used extraordinary high doses of starches, and they come with a dose limitation. And the one thing we learned from these studies was that the more you give, the more your kidney injury risk increases. So that's a takeaway point, but really important not to use a high volume of the starch for maintenance therapy. Another thing that some of these studies were criticized for is that they included patients with kidney injury. And it is really important to take away from this, do not give a starch solution to a patient that has pre-existing kidney injury. And then another thing these studies were looking at was they were comparing starches to normal saline, and normal saline by itself can cause kidney injury. We now know, at the time it wasn't that clear, but now we know that normal saline actually causes kidney injury by itself. Overall, these studies were large studies, and they were published in New England Journal and JAMA. And they're overall good studies, but they have some inconsistencies that are really important to keep in mind when you interpret the data of these studies.
Okay, I think that's really important, and people can take a look. We'll post them with the show notes. Are there other trials that you think would be important for people to take a look at?
So there have been another three trials that showed somewhat positive results with the use of starch in ICU patients. Those were named the Crystal trial, the Christmas trial, and the first trial. I believe the first trial was not done in the ICU patients, but in the perioperative setting. Those studies have also been criticized because, again, they compared to lower molecular weight starches, newer starches, to normal saline, which by itself can cause kidney injury. Some of the studies were criticized for only selective data publication, so they only published some of their primary and secondary outcomes and left others unmentioned. And those are some of the shortcomings. And the Crystal trial looked at all different kinds of colloid solutions, but interesting to know is that in the Crystal trial, the subset of people that had the best results was the group treated with starches. One important thing about the last three trials is why did they show better results? And maybe one of the reasons is because they were used in the initial phase of resuscitation. But again, I do not want to recommend the use of starches in ICU patients. I think there's still significant risk involved with it. I would just not use them, especially in the US and in Europe where we have better colloids available.
So, Maris, you said that those latter three trials showed some positive results. By that, do you mean they didn't show harm or they actually showed some benefit? Tell us a little more about that.
So that's another great question because the data where starches show a benefit are scarce. Some of these trials showed benefits mostly in their secondary outcomes, so they were not powered for that. But overall, the data is weak. The Crystal trial showed a decrease in 90-day mortality, less ventilatory days, and less overall solution used, less volume used in these patients. But it's not very convincing. And importantly, in ICU patients, I'm not expected to find very convincing data on its use based on the implications of the glycocalyx.
So, Marius, you know, it sounds like there's still a lot of controversy. There's some studies that maybe, though not definitively, showed maybe some benefit. Other older studies which showed that there was some harm. We've even said here, you've said, you know, I think if you had other options, then might be better to do it. Do we need a more definitive study? And if so, what would we look for? What kind of study would you design if you wanted to really answer these questions definitively?
Great question. I'll take a step back and share a story here because I was talking to one of our great ICU attendings the other day, and one thing he mentioned is, all right, we looked at thousands of patients and we don't see a benefit. So there probably isn't a big difference. So should we even... care so much about it? Because if there was a big benefit or a big harm, we would know about it by now definitively. I think it's a little more tricky than this because, and I'm going to talk about that in a second, we need to design a study where you take a theoretical rationale into use, meaning the glycocalyx and a clinical setting where you expect the colloid to improve your preload. And second, we use crystalloid and colloid solutions in so many patients. It's estimated that over the course of a year, about 230, 240 million people undergo surgery, and all of them, or almost all of them, get some sort of crystalloid or colloid solution. So I think it's very important that even if there is a small difference, we find it, because it would have large implications on the people. And I don't expect any of the solutions, whether it's crystalloid or colloid, to make a huge difference. I think the number needed to treat is exceedingly high, which can only be justified by the fact that we treat so many patients with that medication. So if I were to design a study on the use of starch, if it was my intention to prove its benefit, I would look at the initial resuscitation phase in the OR, meaning, again, coming back to the example I used earlier today, you have a large tumor, debulking surgery, or amputation, or extensive orthopedic surgeries, where you encounter steady but slow volume losses. At some point, you will need to transfuse these patients. You will need to give blood products. But in the meantime, before you reach a certain hemoglobin level, you want to stabilize their cardiac preload without giving them too much crystalloid, because, again, it would cause more edema is the rationale behind it. So I would look at this kind of patient population. And there's two studies on the way in Europe. One is the Phoenix study. The other one is the Tetis study. They're going to look at this, and I would keep looking out for these studies, because if you don't hear from them, it may be an indicator that they couldn't find a big benefit of starches. One of the downsides of these studies is they're industry-funded. Also, some of the studies we talked in the ICU setting are industry-funded, so you always got to be careful. And I highly recommend, if you're interested in whatever clinical topic and you're looking out for studies, go on to clinicaltrials.gov and look for those studies and look what are they looking for in their primary, secondary outcome, and then later on what is actually being reported when these studies get published. So those are two trials that I think it's worth looking out for. We're excited to see the results of these trials. And then if you don't see a benefit at some point, you may also want to think, should we really still use starches? We may not want to. I think we should wait for the results of these studies. And I think we should keep the things in mind we discussed here before we ban those solutions altogether.
I was going to ask you, Marius, are they being banned? Are they being restricted?
Yes, they are. The European Pharmacovigilance Risk Assessment Committee of the EMA, the European equivalent of the FDA, is currently pushing to ban those solutions. I think at this point in time, we do not have the evidence to ban them for good. I think we should limit its use. Interesting to know, why did they push forward in banning the fluids? They were incentivized by a study that looked at current practice of prescription of starch solutions and found that they're still being prescribed in patients with kidney injury and septic patients. So they figured, okay, we may as well just ban them altogether. But I don't think it's smart at this point. I don't think we're there yet. There was an expert committee involved that actually recommended against the ban. So it's currently being revisited. If I can give you an example, for example, if you ban starches, you may also want to think about banning normal saline, because it causes a lot of problematic effects. But I think there's still a role in certain clinical settings for normal saline, so I don't think we should ban either one of those two, not at this point in time.
Gotcha. And there are, of course, also some downsides to increasing the use of crystalloid, especially if it's normal saline.
Theoretically, yes, there is. It's very hard to study that. People looked at abdominal surgeries and a large amount of crystalloids, which can damage a lot of important structures in the vascular system. So there may be downsides from using too much crystalloid, and there may be a downside from banning starches, not having albumin available, and now infusing 4 instead of 2 liters of crystalloids. So there may be harm with that.
Great. All right. Marius, this has been great. Anything that we haven't covered that you think we should hit before we sign off?
I think we covered a lot. I think this can be hard to digest, and sometimes I need to listen to your podcast multiple times before I get the picture. I want to thank at this point some of the faculty here at Johns Hopkins that helped me in preparation with this talk. But I think at this point is a good summary of the situation we find ourselves in.
Great. Thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you. Thanks, Jed.
All right. That was great. I love that Marius took the time to research this and then to come do an episode. If you have comments, go to the website, acrac.com, where you can leave comments that everyone can learn from. You can also see the references. You can see all our other episodes. And you can join the mailing list if you'd like. If you are a fan of the show, please consider going to iTunes and leaving a comment and a rating. It really helps others find the show. And if you're interested in supporting the making of the show, you can go to patreon.com/acrac. That's patreon.com/accrac, where you can become a patron of the show. Even if it's just a dollar or two that you pledge, we are really grateful. It makes a big difference. If you prefer to make donations when and how you would like, you can also go to paypal.me/acrac. That's paypal.me/accrac. And you can make a donation anytime you feel like it and as much as you'd like. Any little bit is, of course, greatly appreciated. Thank you so much to those of you who are already patrons or have already made donations. And, of course, to Brian Park for the outlines he's made for some of the episodes. And that is going to be it for today. Thanks so much for listening. For the ACRAC podcast and Dr. Marius Fassbinder, I'm Jed Wolpaw. Remember, what you're doing out there every day is really important and valued.
Are you looking for legit ways to make extra money? Our friends at The Side Hustle Show have put together this cool free 60-second quiz to help you do just that. All you got to do is go to hustle.show. You can do it right from your phone. Answer a few short multiple choice questions, and it'll recommend a few episodes of the hit Side Hustle Show podcast to start with. You can add your personalized Side Hustle Show playlist to your device, learn what works, and start making more money today. Again, that's at hustle.show, or follow the award-winning Side Hustle Show in your favorite podcast app.